And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is absolutely committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds. And I'm really looking forward to the podcast that we're just about to engage in. Before we do, however, I want to say if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe, rate, review. It helps a lot. And we're going to be talking about a particular book called Humans 2.0. And I absolutely love the title of this book. But this book is available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. You can get a copy for standing shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth by simply going to the web at equip.org or writing me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Our guest today has made great contributions to the Christian Research Journal. His name is Fuzz Rana. He is president. He's the chief executive officer of Reasons to Believe, an incredible ministry. He has a PhD in chemistry. He's the author of many different articles, as I just mentioned, some of which have appeared in the Christian Research Journal. He's the author of quite a few books, but the book we're really interested in today, and a book you have to read. I mean, this is cutting-edge stuff. Humans 2.0, subtitled Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Perspectives on Transhumanism. Now, if you don't know what transhumanism is all about, this will be your primer. This book is so interesting in the way it's designed. I get chills when I think about the chapters. Each one of the chapters really relates back to a superhero, something we're familiar with. But you start to understand that there's rhyme and reason behind why we gravitate towards superheroes. And I'm going to ask Fuzz about that as we get into the podcast. But first of all, just a delight to have you on the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Well, Hank, it's an honor and a privilege to be invited onto your show, so thank you so much.
Well, you are welcome, and of course, this book is co-authored with Ken Samples, and he used to work at the Christian Research Institute, and I've been following his development over the years and so proud of the person he's become, and certainly an incredible intellect.
Yeah, good friend, and love the man to death, and he's shaped and influenced the way I think about so many things, so it's an honor to call him a friend.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to start with what I just mentioned, superheroes. What an interesting way to design the book and to make a correlation between our fetish, so to speak, with superheroes and the transhumanist movement.
Yeah, well, you know, I have the true confession here. I collect comic books. I'm a comic book buff to my wife's horror. You know, my garage is full of stacks of comic books. But, you know, one of the things that's fascinating about comic books and superhero comics in general is it really is a theodicy, a response to the problem of evil. The world is not the way it's supposed to be, and that we imagine the need for a savior. And so these superheroes represent a type of savior. They provide a pathway for salvation, rescuing people from, again, you know, dire predicaments, but also really trying to correct the wrongs in the world. And, you know, one of the superheroes I've long been fascinated with is Iron Man, right? And in a sense, Iron Man represents really a solution to the problem of evil, where our salvation is found in what we can understand about the world through science and what we can then turn into technology. This is sometimes called techno-faith, where we turn to science and technology to solve the biggest problems that confront us as human beings. And for many people, maybe the chief problem is our mortality. And can technology grant us a type of eternal life, if you will?
Yeah, techno-faith is a term we'll get back to a number of times in the podcast. But I think what would be really helpful at the outset is to get some kind of perspective in an overarching sense of what transhumanism is. What does it embody?
Yeah. Well, you know, if there's the ultimate expression of techno-faith, it would be this idea of transhumanism. And I find that many people have never heard that term, but they're very familiar with the concepts of transhumanism because it is the stuff of science fiction, right? In a nutshell, transhumanism is this philosophical movement in which the objective is to use technology to correct our flaws in our biological makeup, to transcend our limitations as human beings, with the hope of maybe even extending human life expectancy to a practical immortality. Some transhumanists argue that we ought to use science and technology to evolve humanity into these post-human species that would be so different from us that we wouldn't recognize them as humans. And this idea, as I mentioned, is the type of thing that you would expect to see in science fiction. And it's an idea that's been around for well over a century, but nobody in the academy really took it seriously. It was a fringe idea, but within the last decade, there's been incredible advances in three areas: gene editing, brain-computer interface technology, and in anti-aging technology that suddenly give legitimacy to this transhumanist vision. And it's now been propelled from the fringe of the academy into the mainstream, and it's very much infiltrating pop culture, infiltrating our world at large. I would submit that it may very well be one of the most important ideas that will shape the world that we live in the next couple of decades.
And one of the points you make in the book is that techno-faith, transhumanism, is rooted in a concept that comes out of the Enlightenment. It's the idea that there's such a thing as progress in a cultic sense, the cult of progress or the myth of progress. Help us understand the myth of progress.
In a nutshell, it's this idea that as we develop a better understanding of the world, as we develop new technologies, we are inexorably going to move into better and better places as human civilization, ultimately attaining a type of utopia. And this is the mindset that, you know, fuels really transhumanism and really fuels much of what we see in science and technology, that if we can only make that next discovery, if we can only develop that next technology, things are just going to get better. And so many people operate in that mindset, whether they fully appreciate that or not, that technology is the path to, you know, ultimately a type of utopian future. And to be clear, technology has changed our world, it has improved the lives of many people, but the story is a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, and that's why you use Iron Man again, because he's the embodiment of techno-faith and therefore the melding of man and machine in a way that really is emblematic of the cult of progress.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, even though Iron Man is a superhero, you know, and he's the stuff of comic books, the Iron Man comics have been pretty sophisticated over the years in engaging the relationship between human beings and technology. And so, yes, indeed, he is an embodiment of techno-faith, but there's a number of themes that emerge in the Iron Man comic over and over again, like the question of identity. What does technology do to our identity? And with Iron Man, he's obsessed with developing armor that becomes more and more integrated into his personal being, to the point where does Tony Stark end and Iron Man begin, for example, right? Or, you know, Iron Man embodies our addiction to technology. We want more, we want more, we want better, we want better. And even it exposes our vulnerability, that technology improves our lives, but it also makes us vulnerable in new ways because of our dependence on the technology.
And as human beings, we're all subjected to the idea of transhumanism because we have this innate sense of transcendence that's built into our very nature as human beings.
Yeah. You know, it's very easy to look at transhumanism as a philosophical movement and almost dismiss it as being extreme or maybe even a little bizarre. But, you know, we were just chatting off air, you know, I turned 62 today. And so, you know, I want to do what I can to live as long as I can, to be as healthy as I can. And so there are developments in anti-aging technology that look very attractive to me, right? And so this anti-aging pathway may be what makes transhumanists of us all, where we are looking for, can we take drugs? Can we, you know, develop some kind of regime that, you know, helps to extend our life expectancy? Can we actually intervene and disrupt the aging process? There are scientists who think that we not only can arrest the aging process, but maybe even reverse it. And so this leads to all kinds of very interesting ethical questions, but there's an appeal to that, that maybe becoming a human machine, you know, hybrid, a cyborg, isn't that appealing to me, right? Or having my genome altered with gene editing. But boy, if I can do something to extend my life expectancy, it's going to be very attractive to me, even though I operate within a Christian worldview. There's something, you know, within me that craves, you know, what transhumanism offers.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I really like about your book is you're not telling us what to think. You're teaching us in this book how to think about transhumanism. And I think that distinction bears elaboration.
Yeah, you know, and I appreciate that you picked up on that point, because who am I to tell anybody what to think about something as complex as transhumanism? But if I can at least suggest to people ways in which we can engage this idea as really a community of Christians, where we all need to be working together to help formulate the response, that could be the best thing that I could accomplish, is to make people aware of transhumanism, how important this idea will be, and to give people some ways to think about it so that we can then effectively engage this idea with the idea of really pushing the gospel forward. But, you know, there are many issues, to be quite frank, Hank, that I have wrestled with related to transhumanism that I'm not even sure what I think or what I believe, right? These are complex issues. I need to hear your input. You know, hopefully you need to hear my input, and we need to debate it with each other in, you know, in a spirit of love, with the idea of how do we formulate the best engagement from a Christian perspective. And there may not be a single way to approach this from a Christian perspective.
What's great about this book as well is you get into some very complex issues. You mentioned gene editing, and you warn the reader, this is going to be heavy duty material. It might take a while to slog through this. Maybe you want to skip ahead, and you can do that without losing the sense of this book. But let's talk about gene editing for a moment. What is gene editing? And also, I want you to touch upon the complexity of gene editing in the sense that it not only affects an embryo at a particular stage, but it will affect the lineage of that embryo in perpetuity.
Yeah, you know, and gene editing has been the dream of medical doctors and geneticists for probably a good 50 years, maybe even longer than that, with the idea that, look, many human diseases involve genetic defects. There's mutations that have taken place that introduce genetic defects in our genome. And in fact, there's probably somewhere between 5,000 to 10,000 diseases that are of genetic nature that involve a mutation in a single spot in the genome. Many of them are rare. There's not really any kind of treatments for them. And maybe about 10, 15 years ago, a researcher at Stanford University invented this new technique for gene editing called CRISPR gene editing. And it's a very powerful way to alter genomes of organisms, including human beings, with a high degree of precision. It's very easy to use. It's very inexpensive. It literally is revolutionary. And since that time, people have developed all kinds of different variations of the technique. But we now have a toolkit where we can literally go in and alter the genetic makeup of any individual precisely the way that we would want it to be altered. this is going to revolutionize medicine in terms of treating genetic disorders again, and maybe even curing people that have genetic diseases. In fact, about a year ago, there was a small-scale clinical trial involving about 40 people with sickle cell anemia, and using CRISPR gene editing, they cured 75% of the clinical participants of sickle cell anemia. That's absolutely unheard of, right? To have that kind of success. So this is a reality that's increasingly upon us. Even though it's a very simple technique to use, there's a lot of complications that prevent it from moving into a clinical setting, but it really is a very powerful technique, again, that will change medicine in many respects in good ways. But that same technology now can be used to create designer human beings as well, or even to modify human beings so that we're stronger and maybe more intelligent or more psychologically well-adjusted. At least that would be the vision that some people have of gene editing. But when it comes to gene editing, you know, you can, you know, for example, with sickle cell anemia, what you're doing is you're gene editing particular cells that would be found in bone marrow so that you now produce healthy red blood cells. But you're not really altering the genetic makeup of that individual. So if that individual has a child, that child very well could have sickle cell anemia. The gold standard would be to do gene editing at the embryo stage, right, where you are, you know, making that genetic correction in the embryo. So then when that embryo grows and develops, that genetic defect would not be part of that individual's makeup.
Or the lineage of that individual.
That's exactly right. But, you know, there's all kinds of problems with this because you've got to do genome screening of the mother and the father. Then you have to then basically do gene editing on all the embryos that you would generate through in vitro fertilization. Those that weren't successfully gene edited would be destroyed. You know, so there's a lot, it's gruesome in many respects. I mean, that is the cost. And if you happen to do the gene editing in such a way that not only you correct the genetic defect, but maybe introduce other genetic changes that you're unaware of, as you said, when that individual reproduces, that genetic defect is now introduced into the human gene pool. And so that in and of itself is deeply concerning. So, you know, there are ways in which this technique can be used that raise minimal ethical issues. There are other ways the technique that can be used that even in a medical context raise just horrendous ethical concerns. And then when you start thinking about enhancements, you know, you are in a completely different ethical regime at that point.
Yeah, and I suppose it depends on what worldview you attack this issue on. What is your worldview when you're involved in gene editing? Makes all the difference in the world. A point that you make throughout the book is the destruction of embryos, which you alluded to just a few moments ago. From your worldview and my worldview, when you destroy an embryo, you're destroying a human being created in the image and likeness of God.
Yeah, that is one of the chief concerns, you know, with gene editing, particularly, again, if you're working at the embryo stage. You know, but this idea of worldview is really very important, as you're pointing out, Hank, you know, because as a Christian, we take the view that human beings are made in God's image and have infinite worth and value. And so on one hand, we want to do whatever we can to promote human flourishing, right, to mitigate pain and suffering when we can. But we also recognize that we want to protect human beings. We want to make sure that we're protecting those people that are marginalized. That would include embryos. But even then, there's also going to be, you know, women that provide eggs for in vitro fertilization that could be exploited as well. So that exploitation is pretty extensive when you start playing out different scenarios. So the Christian worldview is very powerful in the sense that it's not anti-science, it's not anti-technology, but it also puts in place safeguards that ensure that the technology is going to be used in the best possible way. This is something that secular worldviews don't really offer in any way, shape, or form. which is why it's so important, I think, for Christians who are interested in science and technology and medicine to actually think about pursuing careers in things like brain-computer interfaces and in things like gene editing, because they represent a Christian worldview. They're salt and light in an area that desperately needs salt and light. So it's not just enough for us to be informed and engage, you know, but it's also critical that we encourage young people to see this kind of work as part of their calling, right? That they could actually serve God in real ways by being involved in research in gene editing, for example.
That's such a brilliant point. I want to read something that we looked at prior to the podcast. This is about Neuralink. And I want to talk about Elon Musk for a second and Neuralink and brain-computer interface, BCI. And this is something you brought up as well just a few moments ago. But here's what it says in terms of the promo on the website. So Neuralink's website currently claims this: our brain-computer interface is fully implantable, cosmetically invisible, and designed to let you control a computer or mobile device anywhere you go. I mean, that sounds fantastic. What could be the downside to that?
Yeah, well, you know, and again, this is the challenge, is that this technology, like gene editing, can be used for really good purposes, but it could also, you could cross lines very easily and very quickly. And, you know, Elon Musk, to his credit, or to the team at Neuralink's credit, have developed probably a state-of-the-art BCI. This is one of the most exciting and rapidly advancing areas in bioengineering, but he's probably outpaced everybody in terms of what they've been able to create. And so part of the vision is, look, with BCIs, you could implant them into patients who are locked in, that can't communicate, that they can learn to communicate through texting by just simply using their thoughts, or people that are quadriplegic or paraplegic can learn to control exoskeletons and gain movement, or amputees can learn to control robotic prosthetic limbs. So it's going to revolutionize medicine, but people like Elon Musk not only see humanitarian applications, but they see this as the next generation of user interfaces with the electronic devices that are all around us. So instead of a voice command, you just give a thought command. And in fact, Elon Musk is probably, I would call, a reluctant transhumanist, because he's deathly afraid of AI. And he is concerned that we may create these AI systems that actually either subjugate humanity or drive humanity to extinction. And his argument is the only way that we're going to prevent that from happening is if we develop these brain-computer interfaces that allow us to interface our brains with computer systems so that we can now compete with the AI systems that we're creating. And so he's really advocating the creation of a type of human-machine conglomerate, or a cyborg of sorts. And that's where many people that are transhumanists see BCI technology going. So it raises a lot of questions, you know, in terms of what are the boundaries for this type of work. But even for BCI technology that's going to be used simply for medical purposes, there are a lot of very serious ethical issues that are starting to emerge. In fact, there's a whole new area of bioethics called neural ethics, where people are just trying to wrestle through the ethical issues with BCI. So, for example, you can, through BCI technology, stimulate certain areas of the brain that will actually arrest the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. And so this very well may factor in the future in how we help people to manage Parkinson's. The problem is that these BCIs actually alter the personality of the patient, right? They actually make the patient consistently less risk averse. So that then raises questions. Is that patient actually giving consent to the second wave of treatments or not? Would they have given maybe a different response without the BCI? Because they're less risk averse, they may be more willing to have a subsequent treatment because of the BCI itself. Or some of the more sophisticated ones are actually using machine algorithms, basically AI technology, to extract user intent from the electrical activity happening in the brain. And they are interpreting that, and then they are affecting some kind of machine hardware or machine software. Well, the problem here is, who's actually making the decision, right? Is it the patient? Is it the BCI? Or is it some kind of collaboration? And would that patient have made that same decision without the BCI? So even in the most pure applications of BCI technology, you know, where you're seeing it as a means to alleviate suffering that people have because of, you know, paralysis or being locked in from a brain injury or because of a loss of limb, there's all kinds of really deep, profound ethical issues. Now what happens when you start thinking about enhancements or using this in a commercial sense, you know, where this becomes a, you know, the primary user interface between humans and electronic devices? And it's really crazy, Hank, because you can actually tether people's brains together with BCIs. So people can now begin to communicate to one another with BCI technology, you know, where you would route the signal, let's say through the internet. I could actually have my brain tethered to somebody else's brain on the other side of the world, and that we could somehow share thoughts, maybe even conjoin our brains together to solve problems. This sounds like science fiction, but, you know, I just did a literature research a couple of days ago, and this area is progressing at a pretty rapid pace. You know, this BCI, you know, connection from brain to brain.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that you do a great job, you and Ken Samples together, as you wrote this book, you do a great job of pointing out that the worldview you bring to this issue makes all the difference in the world. If you believe in substance dualism, that the mind and the brain are not identical, that the mind is metaphysical, the brain is physical, you have a completely different perspective on BCI than you do if you're a materialist.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, and it depends too on your model for how our material and immaterial aspects of our nature interact. You know, I've seen some models that have been advanced by Christian neuroscientists who would say, well, you know, there's the brain, the mind, and the spirit, and maybe we could call the mind and the spirit the soul, but that the brain can influence the mind can influence the brain, the spirit can influence the mind, and hence the brain. So you've got this three-way interaction. And so even in a substance dualist model, right, you still could have these BCIs somehow altering the immaterial aspect of our nature. So I don't know. I mean, maybe that model isn't a valid model, but it raises all kinds of really hard questions about the brain and the mind and how they relate to each other. And, you know, and again, I'm a substance dualist like you. But for many people like Elon Musk, I would dare venture, they're operating in a materialistic framework where the brain is the mind. And so, you know, they would probably not see the complications that we would see with BCI technology. You know, so I can see, you know, legitimate medical uses for it that as a Christian I could be strongly in support of. But there's other applications I really am troubled by, not only from a, you know, in terms of what could be the unintended consequences of the technology, but even in terms of what does it actually do to human identity, you know, particularly as image bearers.
Speak to this issue of, maybe I should say this mythology, I'll let you be the judge, but this idea of uploading your mind to a computer so you can achieve immortality.
Yeah. I personally, because of my worldview, don't think that is ever going to be possible, right? I don't think we're going to be able to actually do something like that. But it doesn't matter so much what I think. What matters is what other people think, right? And so you could very well, if people are convinced that really our brain is who we are, that they would very much look to something like, you know, uploading the essence of who we are into a machine hardware, because that's a way to gain a type of digital immortality, if you will. And so there very well could be a lot of people that find that idea alluring, even if it's not, at the end of the day, technically feasible, whether because of the limitations of the technology or because of, you know, a misunderstanding about the complexity of human beings, you know, and neglecting to take into account our immaterial nature. But, you know, that idea of uploading our mind, let's say, into a machine framework is really intriguing because, in a sense, it's not going to actually give people what they want. It's not going to actually make them immortal, because what they're doing is they're uploading a copy of their brain. They're not uploading their brain into machine framework. And so it's not them that actually is going to live forever, but a copy of themselves. So I don't think people have thought this through thoroughly, you know, who are advocating that kind of an idea. But, you know, what I've come to appreciate again is it's not so much what's technically reasonable that's important. It's what people think is reasonable. And if people think that something is possible, even if it isn't, they're going to make decisions, critical life decisions, based on what they think is possible versus what the reality is.
Something else you mentioned just a few moments ago was anti-aging technologies, and I'd love you to elaborate on that. I mean, there's a sense in which you can say that there's mythology involved here if you have a Christian worldview, because there are parameters around our age. I mean, I'm almost 75 years old. I had an anti-aging technology. I suppose I had a stem cell transplant. And so my immune system was killed. My blood system was completely destroyed. So the blood system and immune system of another person could take the place of my blood system and my immune system. So you kill through chemotherapy and radiation, you kill your blood system, your immune system, then they graft in stem cells, and the stem cells graft into the bone marrow and produce a new blood system, a new immune system. And so here, lo and behold, I'm still alive. I'm still kicking because of an anti-aging, so to speak, therapy. But the idea that I'm going now, I'm in the fourth quarter of my life from the perspective of my worldview. No matter if I live to 100, I'm still in the fourth quarter of my life. So there are parameters, if you have a Christian worldview, around anti-aging. You are going to die. The death rate is one per person. We're all going to make it. And, you know, the Bible really indicates parameters around age in 80 years, or by reason of strength, 80. So around 70 to 80 years, maybe 90, 100 on the outliers and so forth. But there are limitations to our age. And maybe there are good reasons that God designed us that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and again, you know, your point about worldview is really critical. And yeah, I would agree with you that, you know, it's not good to live forever, right? At least in a physical form, in the form that we're in right now, right? That this is not our hope. Our hope is in eternity, where we will have resurrected bodies and we will live forever in the presence of our Lord. But there are good reasons why, you know, God limits, you know, I think, life expectancy, and even people that are not holding to a Christian worldview who deliberate about the ethical issues connected to, you know, anti-aging technology have raised all kinds of very real concerns. It literally would change the world that we live in if suddenly people could live for hundreds of years. It would alter the economic system of the world, right? There's a great Christian thinker, Brent Waters, who influenced me in this respect, that it would lead to what he calls a loss of natality. And what he means by that is that we recognize that we have a finite lifetime and that really the future is represented by our children. And even if you don't have children, you recognize that the future is represented by children. And so we are willing to sacrifice and invest our lives in our children's future, so that they have maybe a better world to live in than we did, that things would be a little bit easier than it is for us, right? And that sense of natality means that we are outward looking in terms of how we live our lives, that we are less selfish, and that lack of selfishness extends to how we engage other people. And his point is that if you have you know, this long life expectancy, no longer are you concerned about the welfare of your children. Your children are now a threat to you, right? And you are a threat to them. You're standing in the way because your goal is to live as long as you can, not to have children and see those children successful. And he argues that that actually would lead to a complete breakdown in the way we understand the world, in that people are going to become inherently selfish. We're not going to be concerned about future generations. We're not going to be concerned about one another. That there's a, you know, there's finite resources, and then we're going to be battling for those resources as we seek to live longer and longer. So there's some very real concerns that, you know, ethicists who are secular arrays, who recognize perhaps, you know, unintentionally the wisdom of God's design to limit our life expectancy, right? And with that being gone, again, people are going to pursue, you know, a type of practical immortality. You know, and it's interesting because there's a growing number of medical doctors who are actually arguing that really we should think about aging not as an inevitability, but actually as a disease. And if it's a disease, it means we can treat it. It means we can cure it. And so there are a growing number of medical doctors who are arguing that we really ought to be redirecting most of our research dollars in medicine to anti-aging, not to cardiovascular disease or diabetes or cancer or stroke work, but rather to anti-aging, you know, where the idea would be that if we can solve the aging problem, all these other dominoes fall and we don't have to be worried about them. So there really is this changing mindset among, you know, biomedical researchers about the nature of the aging process. And again, with that comes this idea that people are going to put their hope in this prospect of maybe through medicine living for hundreds of years, you know, towards attaining a practical immortality.
Yeah, that great prologue to the second part of your book, part two, The Ethics of Human Enhancement. And you talk about ethical challenges there, but one of the things that you raise here is the question, should we play God? And you know, if you have a knee-jerk reaction, you might say, no, of course we shouldn't play God. But you're saying, yes, we should. And there's a reason you say that.
Yeah. Well, and it's because we're made in God's image, right? And so because we're made in God's image, we are creators like our God is a creator, that God has made us, if you, in a sense, quote-unquote co-creators, right? He's given us a creative capacity that we are to implement to understand the world, to develop technologies. We are to subdue the earth, to bring it under our control, right? We are to promote human flourishing. We're to care for the planet. We are to use animals appropriately. We're not to abuse them. And so these are all, we're co-creators, we're co-rulers. You know, we are co-stewards with God. And so as a result of that, we have no choice but to play God. And the real issue is, are we trying to take God's place?
Usurp God.
Right. And so what I see with transhumanism is this is a movement where we're trying to take God's place. I can see using these technologies for medical purposes as we're trying to function in a way that respects the image of God in people and promotes human flourishing. But transhumanism is where we're usurping God. And remember, God gave us dominion over creation, except for one part of that creation, human beings. We don't have dominion over human life. That belongs to God.
Yeah, it's just a powerful distinction and a well-written section. One of the ethical considerations that you bring up in the book is the distinction between adult stem cells and their use, and embryonic stem cells. And I don't think that can be emphasized enough. We sort of touched on it a few moments ago, but I really think this is an area that bears elaboration, both from a moral standpoint, an ethical standpoint, but also from a practical standpoint. There's a big distinction between embryonic stem cells and how they behave and adult stem cells.
Yeah, well, you know, because a stem cell is just simply a cell that is undifferentiated. that has the potential to develop into particular cell types. So embryonic stem cells can develop into virtually any of the 210 cells that make up the human body. Adult stem cells have limited developmental potential, but one of the things that we've discovered is that many adult stem cells in a laboratory setting can actually develop into a remarkably wide range of different cell types, much more so than people would have initially thought. And the beauty is that adult stem cells are coming from adult tissues, right? So we're not creating an embryo and destroying it. We're taking the cells from, you know, existing adult tissue versus embryonic stem cells, which have to come from embryos that have been created specifically to isolate the stem cells. So there's a very different, you know, ethical and moral status to those different types of cells. And most of the success that people have had in the clinic is with adult stem cells. It's not with embryonic stem
cells. That's so interesting. That's so interesting because you don't hear about that nearly as much as embryonic stem cells.
Yeah. Well, and there's another type of stem cell that's been invented, if you will. This was maybe a little bit over a decade ago now, but these researchers took a type of cell from the skin. It's called a fibroblast, and they figured out how to convert it into a cell that is like an embryonic stem cell. And so these are called an induced pluripotent stem cells. So, you know, a mouthful there, but they are very interesting cells that behave like embryonic stem cells, but are not embryonic stem cells. They come from adult tissues. And in fact, next to adult stem cells, a lot of the work that I see today in stem cell biology is with induced pluripotent stem cells. And what's interesting is that the people that developed this were motivated because of the ethical concerns with embryonic stem cells. So this is a place where the Christian community, in a broad sense, this would include Protestants and Catholics and Orthodox Christians, as well as, you know, people from Judaism, maybe even Islam, voiced these ethical concerns with enough force involving embryonic stem cells that there were researchers who may not have otherwise been motivated, realized that if we were really going to make progress with stem cell biology, we've got to sidestep the use of embryos, and were motivated to search for new types of cells like these induced pluripotent stem cells, or were motivated to pursue adult stem cell technology and push it maybe further than people thought it could potentially go. But this is a point where Christians actually, or people of faith maybe is a better way to say this, actually moved the needle in the right direction, right? It doesn't mean that there's still not people pursuing embryonic stem cell work. There are, but there are alternatives now that are not ethically and morally problematic. And I think the lesson to learn from this is that it's so easy to get discouraged when you start seeing things like advances in gene editing, advances in brain-computer interface, advances in anti-aging. I mean, I actively read the scientific literature in these areas. I can't keep up with it. The advances are happening so rapidly, I can't keep up with it. I'm just as surprised as the next person when I read articles about what's been accomplished. And a lot of times it's things that have been accomplished that I never thought would even be possible, you know, even 6 months prior to that. So it's happening so fast that ethicists don't have time to deliberate on the implications of the technology before the next advance happens and the next advance happens. And so it's so easy to get discouraged, you know, when you see this type of thing happening, when you're concerned about the consequences of, you know, gene editing or BCI technology. But I've seen in the past where Christians have engaged our culture in a sophisticated way with their worldview and have influenced the direction that research goes. They have influenced things in a way that is in line with our worldview and our values as Christians. So to me, the worst thing we can do is give up. If we fight the good fight, it's surprising the influence that we can have in the world.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the more brilliant points you made early on in the podcast. We need to get our children and their children involved in the process. Otherwise, the materialists will have the only seats at the table. We need to be represented. The worldview has everything to say about potentiality, even, much less the ethics involved. How about clones? How do clones factor into all of this?
Yeah, well, with transhumanism, I've not seen a ton where people are looking at cloning. In terms of the technology, trying to clone primates, let alone humans, has not been really successful. There's, even though there were like the UFO cult, the Raelians and their company CloneAid, and some other physicians a couple of decades ago made claims that they had cloned humans, the fact of the matter is cloning humans for reproductive purposes is right now not even on anybody's radar screen in terms of having the technical capability. Where cloning does factor into this, though, is in the creation of embryos for isolating embryonic stem cells. So people are looking at creating clones through a technique called somatic cell nuclear transfer, where you're taking the nucleus from an adult cell and you're transferring it into an egg cell that has had its nucleus removed. And now you're creating what's called a clonal zygote or a clonal embryo. And some people try to argue, well, because this is an embryo that has not been made through normative reproductive means, it technically doesn't hold the status of as a human. I think that's a very flawed argument. I see it as being a human being. And so cloning does factor into the creation of embryonic stem cells, where people see embryonic stem cell work and human cloning is kind of going hand in hand in that sense. And so this is an area that is, again, deeply problematic. So it would factor into the anti-aging technology in terms of, you know, trying to create embryonic stem cells that you could then implant into the patient who would have donated the genetic material in the first place to make that clonal zygote.
I made a little note in the margin of your book as I was reading because I wanted to be reminded to ask you about if gene editing is used to produce a high-tech baby, for lack of another moniker, a high-tech baby, isn't that essentially eugenics?
Yes, that's
it's
really
a science of being well-born.
Yes, that's really perceptive. It is a version of eugenics. You know, and this is one of the ethical concerns with using gene editing to treat people with genetic disorders. And by all means, I'm all for exploring aggressively how we can use gene editing to treat genetic disorders. But we could easily move into a regime where we begin to look at people with genetic diseases as somehow being substandard, as somehow, you know, not having the same value or worth as somebody who is quote unquote genetically healthy. And so then the pressure would be to use the technology to modify your genetic makeup so that you are genetically healthy, right? So you could see this representing a type of genetic discrimination and a high-tech version of eugenics as we move into the future, where, again, people with genetic diseases are going to be marginalized or be viewed as being, again, substandard in some respect. And you can easily...
That's happening in Iceland, right? Where you're basically getting rid of all the Down syndrome babies. There are no incidents, at least said, no incident of Down syndrome babies in Iceland. But the reason is they're all being killed. They're all being aborted.
Yeah, that's a beautiful illustration of the use of technology for eugenics purposes. So you're not discriminating against people based on ethnicity and race, but you're discriminating them on the basis of their genetic makeup, right? And are they viewed as quote unquote healthy or unhealthy from a genetic standpoint? But you could easily envision a future where, you know, the society is such that before a couple reproduces, they have to go through genetic screening if they've identified, you know, particular genetic variants that may make their child susceptible to a genetic disease, that they are forced into in vitro fertilization, where those embryos have to be gene edited. you know, before they could have children, right, to ensure a genetically healthy child. And you could see a scenario where if you didn't agree to do that and you had a child that was genetically defective, that child would be discriminated against, or maybe the family and the child would be denied medical care, you know. And so there's a very real possibility of a type of eugenics emerging from this that is horrifying in many respects.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk about human exceptionalism as you do in the book. How would you make the case for human exceptionalism? And this is all being considered within the purview of technologies producing people that are superhuman or transhuman or human 2.0.
Yeah, well, there's someone that I've had the privilege of debating a couple of times named Peter Clark, who is a transhumanist thinker. And Peter Clark argues that the work in transhumanism completely decimates this idea of human exceptionalism, where he argues that the take-home lesson from transhumanists is that the human condition isn't particularly sacred, right? There's nothing special about us. And so what we do in the book is we actually engage that idea and argue that we can actually make a case that human beings truly are exceptional. And part of that is presenting a scientific argument for the fact that human beings bear God's image, right? And with the idea that really the image of God concept forms the foundation of the Christian ethic that we would use to engage transhumanism and human enhancement technologies. And one of the points that I make is that if you think about it, transhumanism ironically doesn't undermine human exceptionalism, actually demonstrates human exceptionalism, because there's no other creature that has ever lived or currently exists that has the wherewithal to A, understand the world through science, and then to develop technology, and then B, to envision using that technology to take control of quote-unquote evolution, right? To imagine altering themselves through that technology that they create. It's only human beings that are even capable of imagining something like transhumanism. And that in and of itself says that we are distinct and unique and special compared to all other creatures. And that capability appears to be a manifestation of four qualities or four attributes: our ability to represent the world with symbols and then in turn manipulate those symbols in a near infinite number of ways, our theory of mind, where we recognize that others have minds like ours and that we desire to connect with other people with those other minds. And as a result, because of our significant intellect and cognitive capacity, we can structure relationships with other people through very sophisticated societal structures. And it's that combination of properties that seemingly makes human beings unique. You know, it's interesting, Hank, as you're, I'm sure, well aware, you know, Darwin's idea that we only differ in degree, not kind, from other creatures has shaped the science of anthropology for 150, 170 years. And there is a growing minority of anthropologists who are thoroughly entrenched in an evolutionary framework, who wouldn't necessarily align with the Christian worldview in any way, shape, or form, who are actually arguing Darwin was wrong, that human beings actually differ in kind, not degree, from other creatures, that we actually stand apart. And the attributes that they think makes us exceptional, you could see as maybe scientific descriptors of how we would understand the image of God, or at least how some Christians would understand the image of God. And so by taking advantage of this idea of human exceptionalism that's emerging as a scientific idea, connecting it to the image of God, we can actually show that it's scientifically reasonable to think that humans bear God's image and that we are justified in building an ethical system around that concept. But it also means that this idea that transhumanism is somehow undermining human exceptionalism is really a very weak argument.
Yeah, and you mentioned Neanderthals in this regard with respect to a weak argument. I mean, that argument is used by the materialist, saying that we really are not exceptional.
Yeah, so to me, it felt like it was worth spending time in the book really justifying the image of God concept, that it's not just simply a position we're taking on faith as Christians, but it's a position that we can take that has scientific credibility. You know, maybe it's not proved or demonstrated scientifically, but it has scientific credibility because of this idea of human exceptionalism, and that it's now becomes a legitimate framework to create an ethical system that can engage, you know, ideas like transhumanism.
Yep. Talk about the origin of language in relation to human exceptionalism.
Yeah, well, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's our capacity for symbolism that really causes us to stand apart. And symbolism simply means that we are able as human beings uniquely to represent the world in symbols. And then we can combine and recombine those symbols in a variety of ways. That's essentially the basis for language. It's the basis for music. It's the basis for art. And I see that as really being emblematic of the image of God. And what's interesting is that evolutionary biologists cannot explain the origin of language, right? That every approach that has been taken to try to come up with an evolutionary model to explain how language could evolve from just simply animal communication falls short. And it's also interesting that when humans appear on the scene, modern humans, us, when we appear on the scene, the evidence for symbolism in the archaeological record shows up suddenly out of nowhere. Sometimes this is referred to as the sociocultural Big Bang by anthropologists. So it looks like when humans appear, right away there's something different about us that causes us to stand out. And, you know, it's interesting because of our capacity for language, and this is a point that atheists who are anthropologists make, not me, that because of our capacity for language, that even though our technology began, you know, quote unquote, in primitive form, within a relatively short period of time, we've put people on the moon. We're now contemplating, you know, taking control of evolution, quote unquote, to evolve post-human species. Whereas creatures like Neanderthals had technology, but it was static. It never changed. And so the point would be there's got to be something different. And the argument is that that difference is our language capacity. And I would argue that that is really a reflection of the fact that we bear God's image, and even Neanderthals did not.
Yeah, this is something so fascinating in your book. I mean, there's so many interesting aspects of this book. A special focus section in which you talk about artificial womb technology, for example, which I want to get to in a little bit. But it's interesting as you talk about language that, and I've written about this in other venues, but we are hardwired for language from birth. But a point that you made in the book that I hadn't really considered fully is the fact that even before a child is born, they've already picked up language skills from the surrounding world. So from the womb, they're already being educated in language.
Yeah, that's absolutely remarkable that, yeah, even in the womb, there's development that's happening. You know, and as you said, it's because we're fundamentally hardwired and, you know, for language. And I see that again as, you know, a reflection of the fact that we bear God's image. Mm-hmm. This is part of the case that we can marshal to say that really humans are distinct. We stand apart from all creatures.
Absolutely. And maybe this is a bit redundant, but I think we'd be remiss if we didn't repeat some of this because it's complex, it's interesting, it's emotive. I mean, it's a fascinating topic, but I want to have you emphasize how the Christian worldview helps guide ethical deliberations on the use of all of these biotechnologies we've been talking about. I mean, if you're a materialist, you say, look, we're just molecules in motion. So there really are no ethical guidelines except artificial ethical guidelines. But you say, no, there is a worldview that we have been given because we're created in the image and the likeness of God that guides all ethical and moral decisions we make. And it's not arbitrary. It's not happenstance. It's not societal. It's a function of the way we were created.
Yeah, you know, and this is something that, you know, I marvel at, Hank, is, you know, the Christian ethical framework is flowing out of scripture that is thousands of years old, where the people that were inspired by the Holy Spirit writing the words of scripture had no concept of what we're dealing with today, right? With the implications of science and technology today. But yet these ideas that, again, form the basis of Christian ethics are so robust that they can be applied thousands of years later in situations that no one could ever imagine. That, to me, says that there's something about the Christian worldview and the ethical framework that we really ought to be paying attention to, right? And it all centers around the idea that we bear God's image. Because we bear God's image, every human being has infinite worth and value. Because we bear God's image, we have responsibilities that include subduing the earth, bringing it under our control, ruling over the earth, caring for the planet. All of this implies that we need to understand the world and develop technology. So the Christian ethical framework advocates science, it advocates technology so that we can fulfill the roles that God has given us as image bearers, that we want to promote human flourishing, we want to mitigate pain and suffering, we want to see genuine progress happening in the world, but we also recognize that there are boundaries, and those boundaries are such that we want to ensure that we are protecting those people that are marginalized, right? That we don't want to harm human beings in any way, or we don't want to compromise our identity as human beings. Is because bearing God's image is the means by which we enter into a relationship with the Godhead mediated through Christ. So we want to protect our identity as human beings as well. And this tension between promoting human flourishing but protecting the marginalized, we're concerned about injustice in the world. We want equitable access to these technologies. This all is a very powerful framework that helps us, I think, effectively navigate a lot of this technology in sometimes very clear black and white ways. Sometimes there are shades of gray, but those shades of gray are nothing like what a secular ethicist has to deal with. Secular ethicists are very good at giving dimension to the problem, saying, well, these are the ethical concerns, but they don't really have a framework that actually helps them to make deliberations as to what should be the right decision, or what is a collection of decisions that would be more right than wrong. All they can rely on is utilitarianism, right? You know, or some kind of consequentialism. But who decides, you know, what really is, you know, promotes the greatest happiness for the greatest number, or minimizes, you know, pain and suffering? Who gets to make that decision? Or, you know, why is sentience such an important criteria, the idea of self-awareness? For many ethicists that are secular, this notion of self-awareness and or sentience becomes front and center. We want to, you know, minimize pain and suffering for those beings that are sentient. If you're not sentient, well, it doesn't matter, right? But how do you measure sentience? Why sentience? What makes that the gold standard? Right? And who decides, again, if you adopt consequentialism, where you determine the right ethical outcome based on the consequences of actions? Well, who's to determine if the consequences are acceptable or unacceptable? So, you know, I don't see secular ethics as really being very helpful at all, you know, in this arena. It really leaves us with more questions and more confusion than actually helping society make some very important decisions about what technologies should we pursue, and if we do, how do we implement those technologies in the right and just way?
Yeah, and what's so interesting in reading your book, I kept thinking as I was reading and rereading your book that You really believe in humans 2.0, but from a different worldview perspective. You believe that Christianity is progressive, that through the sacramental liturgical life of the church, we go from one glory to another. Some people call that deification. Some people talk about it in terms of sanctification, but we continue to progress. Then we die because we're mortal, but we're resurrected, immortal, imperishable, incorruptible. We really do become what we were intended to be before sin entered the world. And this is one of the things you point out over and over again in the book, that the foundational flaw in all of the thinking that does not come from a Christian worldview is they neglect to consider the real problem, which is the problem of sin.
Yeah. You know, I've had a chance to interact with a number of leading transhumanist thinkers over the years, and to me, they are sympathetic people in many ways. And what I mean by that is I increasingly don't view them as being enemies, but rather as people that are desperately seeking hope, purpose, and destiny. Hmm. That these are people who recognize that the world isn't the way that it's supposed to be, that things are broken, right? That there's pain and suffering in the world, and that's wrong. And they want to do something about it. They dream of a utopian future, right? They want justice in the world. They want people to flourish in their own way. They recognize that death is the enemy, that death is really wrong, that it's not natural, it's unnatural, in some respects. Yeah. They see it as tragic that human beings could one day disappear and go extinct. They have a very high view of humanity. And so I'm highly sympathetic to the concerns they have. And what's interesting is that I meet many scientists who see science as a way to erect a barrier preventing the gospel from penetrating, you know. But with transhumanists, it's the opposite. It's through science and technology that they are laying bare the deepest needs that every human being has, which is hope, purpose, and destiny, this desire to connect to the transcendent. They're just looking for salvation in the wrong place. And they're presenting a false gospel as a result of that. You know, but yet at the same time, transhumanists, as part of this false gospel, are unbelievably naive because they do not think about humans' propensity to do horrible things with good technology or with good things. We have this capacity to take the best and to use it for the worst possible uses, right? That's what Christians bring to the table, is an understanding of sin, an understanding of our lack of wisdom, you know, as human beings in a fallen state. And, you know, transhumanists are completely naive to think that things are going to go in the way that they hope they go. They don't factor sin into the equation whatsoever.
Yeah, and I think what a brilliant point made in the book, how there are good uses of technology, there are bad uses of technology, and that technology itself is not the problem. It's, as you point out, sin is the problem. For example, I think a point that you made in the book is the point of nuclear physics. A nuclear power plant is clean, safe energy, but it can also be used to wipe out whole cities like Nagasaki or Hiroshima. So you have to bring a Christian ethic to the table for how you use technology, because technology can be used for good purposes, can be used for very evil purposes as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, and this is, again, to maybe go back to a point we made earlier, this is why it's so critical for Christians to be engaged in these conversations, and again, to encourage young people in the church to consider pursuing careers in these areas, because one of the things that we have as Christians is redemption. We're a redeemed people, that the image of God in us that was damaged as a result of the fall is being recovered when we are born again. It's being through the process of sanctification. We are being transformed more into the likeness of Christ. We are recovering that image of God that was originally created in us, that gave God the confidence to give us responsibilities to be co-rulers and co-stewards and co-creators with him. And so as redeemed people, we have the best chance of anyone of using that technology well. We also have other resources. We have the wisdom of the scriptures. We have the Holy Spirit to guide us, not only as individuals, but collectively as the church. We have an obligation to help our world manage this technology, and we are uniquely poised as Christians to do that.
What's really interesting, though, and you point this out in the book, that there are a lot of people that don't want the Christian worldview represented at the table because that worldview is a danger to the techno-faith, because it's a substitute faith. And there's even a moniker that I read in your book. I had actually not heard about it before. I probably should have, but bio-Luddites. You know, Christians who are involved in this are bringing a worldview that is antithetical to the myth of progress, and therefore they ought to be marginalized or even minimalized by a moniker like bio-Luddites.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we have to be very careful as Christians when we are confronted with emerging technologies to do our homework and to really engage the technology from a position of knowledge and understanding and try to look for ways in which the technology can truly benefit humanity. But it is also important, I think, for people to realize that just, you know, because we can do something doesn't mean we should do it, right? That there really are limits to how we progress. And, you know, so I think it's important for Christians, in spite of those kind of labels, you know, to be willing to say, wait a minute, we really don't think the technology needs to be used that way or should be used that way, or there's going to be problems if we use it that way. And I think the way we can avoid the bio-Luddite label is when people appreciate the fact that we really understand the technology and we're really willing to engage it. Just a real quick story. It's been a few years ago, but I got an email out of the blue from a person who is the president of the U.S. Transhumanist Political Party. Believe it or not, the transhumanists have a national political party, and there's a political party in every state. In fact, I met the person who heads up the transhumanist party in North Carolina, believe it or not. But they saw a YouTube presentation I did on transhumanism, and they were impressed. And they wanted me to come on to this program that was called a virtual and enlightenment salon. So I was on there as a Christian with about 12 other transhumanist thinkers. And they wanted to know how, as Christians, we understand transhumanism and how can they make their message appealing to Christians, right? But they wanted to hear from me because they recognized, even though I was going to be that stick in the mud that was going to tell them that they're naive, they're not taking sin into account, that they're offering a false salvation, because I understood the technology and appreciated how the technology could be used for good purposes, they were willing to engage with me for 3.5 hours. But what was really cool, Hank, was throughout that conversation, we constantly talked about the idea of salvation. Hmm. And that was, it was a natural part of the conversation, because at the end of the day, transhumanism is all about, where can we find salvation, right? That's what it's all about. I mean, even though transhumanism is a philosophical idea and it's couched in science and technology, it really is, at the end of the day, at its deepest core, religious idea.
Yeah, and a point that you make in the book that I think is worth expanding on is, and we've done it to some extent already, but I think in an isolation, it's important to hammer home the fact that, as you have so well pointed out in the book, technologies give, technologies take. It's not as though technology constantly brings us to a new level. There's a side effect to technologies that we have to take seriously as well.
Yeah, you know, and I think we all can come up with our own examples of where, you know, technology has done good things, but has also now created these unintended consequences. And what our tendency to do is to develop new technology to take care of those unintended consequences, which means we were going to have new points of pain and suffering that didn't exist previously. And it's almost like we're in this quicksand where we can't get out the more that we move. And, you know, to me, it's the idea of unintended consequences is really very frightening, because the technology we're dealing with here is very powerful technology. And so when you start talking about things going wrong in ways that nobody could have anticipated, and the technology is very powerful, the ways it's going to go wrong could be absolutely devastating. And so, you know, we want to proceed carefully and cautiously, even when we're using the technology for what we think are good and noble purposes.
Can you make a distinction between two words, post-human and superhuman?
Yeah, I'll try. A post-human, at least in the transhumanist mindset, would be a new type of human species that would be distinct from us as Homo sapiens sapiens. In principle, you would hope that at least transhumanists would hope, that post-human species would be more adept than we would be in terms of living in a technological world. A superhuman would be someone who has been enhanced, who transcends our natural biological limits or natural biological capabilities. And so you could be potentially a superhuman, but still retain your identity as, you know, as a Homo sapiens. I mean, it's one of the things that has emerged out of the CRISPR gene editing technology is something called the biology DIY movement. It's a biology do-it-yourself movement. Because CRISPR is so inexpensive and so powerful and easy to use, there are a lot of people who are not formally trained as scientists who can get access to CRISPR kits and begin to play around doing gene editing on their own in their garage, right? Or in a community laboratory setting. And the people that are behind this movement argue, look, this is such revolutionary technology, it shouldn't be in the hands of the medical and scientific elites. It should be democratized. Everybody should have access to it. And one of the people that is pioneering this movement is a biochemist by the name of Josiah Zahner. And he's a legitimate scientist. He actually worked at NASA for a number of years. And he claims to be the first person to have ever CRISPRed himself, where he literally injected himself with CRISPR gene editing kit that actually inhibits a protein called myostatin. And myostatin is a protein that controls muscle growth. And as the name implies, myo-muscle statin stasis, it actually inhibits muscle growth. If that protein is not active, muscle is going to grow in an uncontrolled way. And in fact, Chinese researchers actually use that CRISPR gene editing kit to inhibit myostatin in dog embryos. And the dogs that were produced were these almost grotesque animals in terms of their musculature. They were just these, you know, and there's a company in Argentina that's looking at using this technique to actually create super racehorses. But this would be an example of using CRISPR gene editing, maybe not to evolve us into post-humans, but to create superhumans who would have unnatural strength, let's say. Now, who knows what the side effects are going to be, right? I mean, you have to be incredibly naive to think you're just going to knock out a critical regulatory protein and not have wide-ranging unintended consequences. But this is the type of thing that people are seriously entertaining in terms of human enhancements. You know, and for somebody who, let's say, is an athlete, you know, this kind of technology is going to be very appealing.
Two parts of the book, I mean, they could be books in and of themselves. The first is artificial intelligence. It's a special focus, artificial intelligence in the post-human world. So the question, of course, this begs is, what is the relationship of artificial intelligence to human enhancement?
Yeah. Well, you know, the brain-computer interfaces that we've talked about, as they become more and more sophisticated, are going to rely on artificial intelligence as a way to extract user intent. So that's very much going to be part of the transhumanist technology. But in addition to that, there are some transhumanists who would argue that if we create, you know, artificial general intelligence, that these entities that we create are going to be persons like us, because they are going to be sentient, they're going to be self-aware, they would be indistinguishable from us as persons. And so the argument is that they would represent what a post-human or a transhumanist world would look like, that not only would it be populated by different types of post-human species of our own making, but even things like, you know, artificial intelligence systems would be, again, part of that post-human world. So it's an idea that is tangential to transhumanism, but also intersects with transhumanism in some significant ways.
You know, there was a conference last November in Athens, Greece, that I participated in. I was on their scientific committee and selecting speakers, and I wish I would have thought of you. But one of the things I said at that conference is that a mega shift in perception is precisely what is needed today, a shift from buying the materialist myth that artificial intelligence is akin to actual intelligence, a shift from believing that computers can develop consciousness, self-awareness, and purposeful choices, a shift to authentic physical and metaphysical realities. So I bring that up simply to say that I see a big distinction between artificial intelligence and actual intelligence. Is that something that you perceive as well?
Yes, I do, because in a sense, the way our artificial intelligence systems work is ultimately through associative learning. This is the type of learning, you know, that's Pavlovian, right? This is how animals learn primarily. And through associative learning, people have shown in computer modeling studies that you can accomplish some very sophisticated problem solving. But as humans, our cognition is fundamentally different than associative learning, where we actually engage in what's called mental time travel, where we can actually project ourselves into alternative types of futures and look at cause and effect relationships in terms of where we are now and what we would need to do to create each of those distinct types of futures. But it's through that process of mental time travel that we actually solve problems by imagining alternate scenarios, and then we can act upon the particular scenario we think is going to be the best, versus associative learning, where it's just trial and error, where you're looking for what is the best possible solution. The thing is that artificial intelligence systems are becoming very sophisticated, and they are increasingly designed to mimic human beings in many different ways. They mimic our responses. They can mimic our emotions. And because we have this capacity called theory of mind, where we recognize that other humans have minds like ours, we know what they're thinking, we know what they're feeling, we can't turn that off. And so we anthropomorphize animals, we attribute to animals human motives, human feelings, human thoughts, when in fact they don't have those. We even anthropomorphize machines. So when we are exposed to an AI system that is fundamentally functioning differently than we function as human beings, but mimics us, it's going to be very tempting to think that that machine is like us, when in fact it isn't. So in a sense, we are our own worst enemy when it comes to distinguishing between AI systems and human beings. Because of our tendency to anthropomorphize, we're going to see something that's fundamentally different than us as being just like us.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. It can't be said enough. I mean, so basically, a computer, no matter how sophisticated, can never replace a man if you have a Christian worldview. In a materialistic worldview, it really becomes a threat. You can have super machines that become more intelligent than human beings. But if you make a mind-brain distinction, it's not as worrisome. There still are attendant problems to AI that need to be considered, but it's not as daunting, where you think that a machine can literally replace a human being because machine simply doesn't have a mind.
Yeah. And that's a very good point that you make, Hank. Very good point.
But the materialist oftentimes demotes the mind in the sense of epiphenomenalism, the idea that the mind just emerges from physical processes. So in a sense, it's just physical itself.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Either the brain is the mind or the mind is, as you said, an epiphenomena, but it's not a truly distinct aspect of our nature that defines, you know, who we are as human beings.
So if you have people like Stephen Hawking or Bill Gates, Elon Musk, they're concerned that machines are a threat to humanity. They could destroy us. They could deny us resources. They could outcompete us. They could actively seek to exterminate us. Would you share the exact same fear in the exact same way, or do you make a significant distinction based on what we've just said?
Yeah, I am a little concerned about AI systems. I don't know that I would share the concerns to the same degree as Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking would have. But I am concerned because these AI systems are becoming more and more powerful, and the people that are creating them do not know how they are working, right? So they've created something that then is functioning in a way that is surprising to them, or the outcomes are unanticipated. Or you have AI systems that are now hallucinating, right? And so it means that we could create something that's powerful. Maybe it's not like us fundamentally, but we could create something that is powerful that we become dependent upon, you know, in terms of specialized, you know, function that, you know, behaves in unanticipated ways and could really be deadly to humanity. But something that is also important to recognize is that there's huge amounts of resources that are currently required for cutting-edge AI technology. You know, if you've heard about Google or Amazon, they have these massive facilities that are running their AI algorithms, and they're consuming huge amounts of energy in order to do that. So I think we're going to reach a point where AI cannot progress much more beyond its current point simply because we are not going to have the resources to actually maintain those AI systems, right? And as soon as you deny those AI systems, those resources, they're going to come to a halt, right? So we still have the ultimate ability to pull the plug, so to speak,
yep,
as human beings. But that's assuming that people put in place safeguards and that those safeguards are fail-safe.
So something you bring up in the book, which I found interesting, it has to do with repercussions of granting citizenship to robots as though they're human beings, and that actually happened in 2017 or 2019 in Saudi Arabia with a robot called Sophia.
Yeah, and that's a, you know, there's an irony there happening in
Saudi Arabia. Yeah, that was not lost on me.
You know, but that is emblematic of, I think, the allure of AI systems being like us in some way. I mean, because the system that they granted citizenship to is Sophia, which is a robotic system powered by AI that's being specifically designed to mimic human emotions so that the users would form an emotional bond with the AI system. And the reason why Hanson Robotics is doing this is because they recognize that there are a lot of people in our world today that just simply are confined to their homes, elderly people who just aren't able to make it out. They don't have family members or friends in their sphere of influence that visit them. And so they're isolated. And so the thought is, if you have these robotic systems, these people will have companionship, and that will improve their mental health, improve their physical health. So there's very good reasons to do this, but this goes back to this idea of anthropomorphizing, you know, a machine, right? We form an emotional bond with a machine because we anthropomorphize. We think that it's like us, but again, it's an AI system that is fundamentally operating through associative learning, very different in terms of our cognition.
one other special focus, and I think we can wrap it up, but the artificial wombs and the post-human world. What is artificial womb technology, and is it viable? Again, it gives and it takes away. I mean, there are really great benefits to artificial womb technology, but there are also significant liabilities.
Yeah, well, the idea behind an artificial womb is literally that, would be creating a technology that would allow a fetus to develop to full term. And a lot of the motivation behind artificial womb technology is trying to develop ways to improve the outcome of children born prematurely. And so the idea would be that if you could place them into an artificial womb that more closely mimicked a womb, that it would actually not only improve their outcome in terms of the fetal development and their health at the time that they would be, you know, quote unquote, born or reach full term, but it might even actually allow us to have preterm children survive if they are born even earlier than 20 weeks, right? And so this could be revolutionary technology in terms of treating children that are born prematurely. But people that are transhumanists see this as a ticket to divorce human reproduction from the human being itself. And so there are some feminists who see for women the fact that they can become pregnant as being a limitation. And so they want artificial womb technology to allow for reproduction without having to be pregnant, without having to endure pregnancy. The technology is developing at a pretty reasonable pace for treating premature fetuses. It's not right now existent for taking an embryo, a single-celled zygote, and developing it through the first several months of, you know, embryonic growth and development. That technology doesn't simply exist. So it's interesting to see that intersection between feminism and transhumanism with regard to artificial womb technology. As a Christian, I actually am highly supportive of developing artificial womb technology because I see it as a pro-life technology, that if you can actually, you know, have artificial wombs that can extend viability, you know, much earlier than 20 weeks, you now have an option so that instead of someone getting an abortion, you could actually have that fetus placed in an artificial womb. So I see it as having very interesting pro-life repercussions and could really be, you know, a technology used, you know, to advance, you know, kind of a pro-life position and really make abortion, you know, obsolete, or, you know, give that woman who is contemplating an abortion an option that could allow the child to live.
It gives and takes away. There's
yes.
Pros and there's cons. What do transhumanists mean when they say that gender itself limits human potential? There's a section in the book, and one thing you point out is the desire to transcend the limitations of gender is not just a feminist ideal. It is integral to the transhumanist movement because, in their view, gender limits human potential.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we're seeing right now with all these gender identity issues and transgenderism is, you know, I think emblematic of how people see gender, right? Where people want to see gender as fluid or as non-existent. They want to be able to use technology to alter their gender. And so I see that very much as part of transhumanism. But if you are able to divorce, you know, human reproduction from the human organism, then suddenly gender becomes unimportant, right? That you could conceive of, you know, at least in some kind of futuristic world, you know, similar to Brave New World, where, you know, reproduction is not part of our lives as human beings anymore, or at least as whatever entity we happen to become. So it is very much part of the transgender movement.
When our president, Donald Trump, said that there are only two genders, was that in effect a direct affront to transhumanism?
I think so. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that we've done at Reasons to Believe, just a quick shameless plug, is that we assembled a team of medical doctors who are volunteers with us, who did a deep dive into the medical literature and produced this massive research document on what the medical science says about gender identity and different issues related to gender dysphoria. And through that process, the medical science really lines up with the biblical view that there are two genders and that, you know, gender dysphoria is when something has gone horribly wrong and there are responsible ways to treat it and irresponsible ways to treat it. And this idea of gender-affirming care is really an irresponsible way to treat it. It does enormous amount of harm. But this is, again, an example of how people are trying to use technology to alter human beings, right? And we see from just the horrific effects of puberty blockers, the horrific effects of gender reassignment surgeries, just how poorly things can go when we try to use technology to modify who we are as human beings fundamentally, right? That we end up creating enormous amount of damage to people. So this is, I think, a warning shot across the bow for people that are transhumanists, that if you naively think that, you know, altering our genetic makeup or, right, you know, creating human cyborgs is somehow the key to a prosperous and utopian future, you're sorely mistaken.
Yeah, and devastating consequences as well. What a terrific book. Again, the book is Humans 2.0, a great title, Scientific, Philosophical, Theological Perspectives on Transhumanism. The book is available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. And it is written by two fantastic people, my guest, Fuzz Rana and Ken Samples. And what an incredible ministry do you have? Reasons to Believe. I mean, a cutting-edge ministry really making a difference for time and for eternity. We're really grateful to you as Christians in all walks of life for the contributions you're making.
Well, thank you, Hank. And, you know, we are very grateful for the work that you guys are doing at CRI. So I see us as kindred spirits and partners in the gospel.
Amen. Well, you're a dear friend, and I deeply appreciate the book, and we'll continue to plug it and look forward to the advances that you make for the kingdom through Reasons to Believe. And do remember that if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe, rate, review. The book available through the Ministry of Christian Research Institute, check it out on the web, equip.org, equip.org, or write us at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Look forward to seeing you next time for more.